This is a TCC Connection production.
Welcome to the TCC Connection podcast series, Interviews with Educators. My name is Jake White, and in this podcast, we're joined by TCC instructors from a wide variety of backgrounds and disciplines. Our guest for today is Dr. Kristen Marangoni, Assistant Professor of English and Service Learning Coordinator. Dr. Marangoni opens up about her various life experiences, how she approaches teaching literature, and we also have a fun discussion about how pertinent the social and political messages of Hulu's adaptation of The Handmaid's Tale are today. I hope you enjoy the conversation, and thanks for tuning in. Welcome to Interviews with Educators. In this podcast, we'll be talking to TCC professors from a wide variety of disciplines and subjects. Today, we're joined by Dr. Kristen Marangoni. Dr. Marangoni, I know you have a lot of jobs and you wear a lot of hats at TCC. What are some of your official titles?
Yeah, and first of all, thank you for having me. I'm so honored that you thought to inaugurate this series with me. So I am an assistant professor of English here at TCC, but I'm also the service learning coordinator. And so service learning, for those of you who don't know, is where it's a pedagogical method by which you try to incorporate some kind of a volunteer opportunity into the classroom in a way that also reinforces course learning outcomes. So those are my two primary roles here at TCC.
And I think service learning is something that a lot of people talk about, but they don't know. Like, how did you get involved with service learning initially?
Yeah, so I've always been really interested in making the classroom applicable to real life situations, and this just seemed like a really natural place to do that. And as I started looking into universities and colleges' mission statements, a lot of times they have this broad statement that they want all students to develop in areas of social and personal responsibility. But this isn't often being directly taught in the classroom. And so for me, it became a way to give my students real-world hands-on experience in the subject matter while also helping the institution to develop some of these larger institutional goals, like personal and social responsibility.
Well, that's awesome. I'm glad that you have your time to devote to that. And, you know, being in your class and the emphasis you put on it, it got me out of my shell. And I really enjoyed that. And I really appreciated doing that.
Awesome.
So I'm glad that you include that, because that was something really unique that I've never done in another class before. And I really enjoyed it.
Very cool.
So, okay, let's get to know you, who you are as a person. So where are you from?
So I am originally from Columbus, Ohio, but also spend some time in Greenville, South Carolina. But I've been out here for about 10 years now, and so I do consider myself to be, you know, local-ish.
Dyed-in-the-wool Okie. I guess if you've been here longer than 5 years, I guess you consider yourself a dyed-in-the-wool Okie.
I think you pass your initiation, right, about 5 years.
You survive your first tornado.
Exactly.
You're good.
Exactly.
So, got any funny stories from your childhood? What was growing up like for you?
This was a hard one. You know, I think when I was a child, I took myself way too seriously. And I mean, I think maybe that has created some funny stories in retrospect. But, you know, I remember crying when a lifeguard told me I went down a water slide too fast. And, you know, I would ration out my M&Ms one at a time. And so that I would have a whole bag last a whole week. And, you know, I would complain every time I got like an A minus on a test. And, you know, so I think looking back, I think I took myself way too seriously. And maybe in 20 years, I'll look back at myself now and I'll be like, wow, I took myself way too seriously. I didn't really learn my lesson. But I remember my daughter, who's 7 right now, she's into creative writing. She's been writing these stories. And she told me the other day, she goes, I wrote this story about a really fun girl named Kristen. And I said, oh, well, I really like this story. I can't wait to hear it. She goes, no, Mom, that Kristen is not you. And so I think maybe in my current stage of life, I still take myself too seriously. But, yeah, I mean, I think one thing that I, as a parent, my goal is to help my kids not take themselves too seriously. And I think I'm doing a pretty good job there. The other day, I switched up. I pack my kids' lunches every day, and I write them napkin notes. And my 3-year-old and my – she was 6 at the time. They got their lunches switched. And so my 3-year-old got a note saying, great job being star student this week. And my 6-year-old got a note saying, do a good job using the potty today. And when I realized what I'd done, I felt so bad. I'm like, oh, she was probably so embarrassed. And I talked to her after school, and I'm like, I am so sorry. I switched your notes around. and your lunches, were you okay mm-hmm. with that? Like, were you embarrassed? She goes, no, I thought it was hilarious. She goes, my teacher saw it too. Mm-hmm. And she's like, are you having problems, Isla? And I said, no, it's my sister's note. And she is able to laugh mm-hmm. things off in a way that I never would have been able mm-hmm. to as a kid. And yeah. so I think that's a parenting mm-hmm. success right there.
That's really cool. And can I just say, I love napkin messages. My mom used to do that for me.
Aww.
And it's still one of the most cherished memories I have as a child. So, you know, I think that when your kids grow up, they'll look back on it and be like, you know, I'm really glad she did this. Like, I haven't kept any of them.
Aww.
And of course, when you're like 7, you don't think about
yeah.
keeping stuff, but I wish I would have, because, you know, I wasn't the best student in school. So like, it helped me, like, knowing that someone had my back no matter what.
Yeah.
And so like, I'm glad, I think your kids will look back on that and be like, my mom always had my back
no
matter
what.
Thanks
for saying that. You know, as the semester gets busier, it's mm-hmm. easier to, you know, let that slide, but mm-hmm. it's a good reminder that they're mm-hmm. meaningful to them.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's cool. That's really cool. I'm glad you do that. So where did you go for undergrad?
Yeah, so I used to be embarrassed to answer this question. I went to a very small private liberal arts Christian college mm-hmm. called Bob Jones University. And my dad had accepted a job offer as a faculty member mm-hmm. teaching accounting for them.
Mm-hmm.
And so basically I got free tuition.
Mm-hmm.
And so I went there for all 4 years of undergrad mm-hmm. and for 2 years of master's degree.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think I kind of went through, it wasn't until my, you know, in college, a lot of times people kind of come to terms, they go through a self-offering mm-hmm. phase. And I think my self-offering phase wasn't really until my master's mm-hmm. Degree when I was getting in trouble all the time. And I think it was because I was just coming to terms with, there were a lot of things that I was mm-hmm. starting to feel very strongly about
mm-hmm.
that were very different from
right.
my upbringing
right.
and yeah
mm-hmm.
so that kind of maybe mm-hmm. feeds into you know the conversation about what it was like
yeah
and I think I would say we used to be very strict
mm-hmm. mm-hmm.
girls would wear skirts
mm-hmm.
like there were very few instances where we could wear pants
mm-hmm.
We were required to wear hose with our shoes.
Mm-hmm.
Boys were required to wear ties, collared mm-hmm. shirts. There were required events on campus.
Mm-hmm.
You had to be in chapel every day. Required fine arts events that you
mm-hmm.
were encouraged to take a date to.
Mm-hmm.
And in fact, they said their philosophy in college was to operate in the place of the parent,
mm-hmm.
which anywhere else is
right.
You know, they say, you know, here at TCC,
mm-hmm.
a parent walks their kid through the admission line, and we're like, ah, helicopter parent right
mm-hmm.
there.
Yeah.
And so it's a very different mm-hmm. philosophy.
Mm-hmm.
And they had reasons for why they wanted to run the
mm-hmm.
college that way. And, you know, at the end of the day, I have to look back and say that was part of my experience.
Mm-hmm.
And that's part of, you know, what's made me who
mm-hmm.
I am today. And it's helped me articulate my current set of beliefs
mm-hmm.
and positions better. I will say, as far as literature goes, I feel like I got a pretty good literary
mm-hmm.
education there.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of exposure to the classics,
mm-hmm.
for sure. I, you know, was required to take classes in Shakespeare
mm-hmm.
and classical medieval literature. I took a whole class in Chaucer. And so I feel like it gave me a very
mm-hmm.
solid grounding
mm-hmm.
For going into the
mm-hmm.
field of literature. And I will say, one of my favorite professors I met there, Dr. Brent McNeely, introduced me to modern and postmodern literature
mm-hmm.
and really encouraged me to broaden my horizons
mm-hmm.
in those areas. And so I have him to thank
mm-hmm.
for my current set of interests today.
Mm-hmm. That's really
yeah.
cool. And just to make another connection, I was raised in a conservative household
yeah.
as well. And I went to a private school, the same private school from 2nd through 4th grade. And our curriculum was Bob Jones.
Yes,
yeah.
they're very prolific
yeah.
with their
yeah.
their curriculum,
mm-hmm.
and they do a lot of outreach with
mm-hmm.
homeschool programs
mm-hmm.
and extension programs.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, for sure.
I will say that the Bob Jones, I remember it was actually pretty good, really intellectually engaging for a 2nd or 3rd grader. I liked it as opposed to the other curriculums I had done in the past.
Well,
so
I'm glad to hear you say
yeah,
that.
So that's good for Bob Jones, at least in that area. How did you end up in Tulsa after Bob Jones and after your
yeah.
undergrad experience?
So I was applying to grad
mm-hmm.
schools, and I was told that it would be tough, you know,
mm-hmm.
especially coming from Bob Jones,
mm-hmm.
and I didn't realize quite how tough it would
yeah.
be. I applied to, I think, 11 or 12 different PhD
mm-hmm.
programs and got accepted into two.
Mm-hmm.
And University of Tulsa was one of them. And the reason that I wanted to be at University, you know, you're encouraged when you're applying for grad schools to kind of try to find out what the school has to offer you and how, and kind of emphasize that in your cover letter, not just write one standard cover letter for everybody. And they had the Stevie Smith archives. And she was actually the first, she was the topic of my first conference paper ever. And so I think I was able to make a convincing case that I would do well at the University of Tulsa. And so when they sent me my acceptance letter, you know, I accepted, but I wasn't given a graduate assistantship, which was kind of rare. And a professor later told me, you know, it was because I came from such a conservative institution, and they kind of wanted me to prove myself to them. And so I showed up with no financial package, just planning on taking out some. I had some money saved up that could get me through about one semester, and then I was like, I need to figure out something. So I show up on campus without a financial aid package. I learned that they were looking for an assistant in special collections. And so I applied for the position as soon as I heard about it. I guess three other people had also applied, but their emails got in later than mine. And because they needed somebody right away. I basically showed up for the interview, and Mark Carlson, head of special collections, said, "Can you start right now?" And so I worked 4 hours the first day when I went into interview. I also worked. And so I worked there for two years in the archives, and that ended up being a really amazing experience. I got to, they were kind of in the middle of a hiring freeze, and they lost their administrative assistant. And so I was part graduate assistant, part administrative assistant, part undergraduate overseer. And so I just happened to be sitting at the front desk where the administrative assistant probably would have sat when Oscar Wilde's grandson called and asked for some help with some research questions. And so I ended up being his personal research assistant for a few months and convinced him that there was enough material here for him to come and make a personal visit. And so I still remember he came to Tulsa and spoke at one of the library fellows dinners, which they're kind of like donors to the library. And I got to come because I was part of bringing him to Tulsa. And he brought me a bottle of wine from Burgundy. And that was pretty awesome. Yeah, so just those kinds of connections, being able to talk with scholars from all across the world. You know, a couple of scholars, you know, mentioned my name in their acknowledgement sections of their books because of things that I helped them get. So that's just really kind of a cool thing to have.
That's really cool. Did Oscar Wilde's grandson mention you?
I don't know if his book's come out yet.
Oh, okay.
I keep waiting for it.
Okay.
But I'll have to check that out.
Yeah, definitely. Definitely. So you come to Tulsa, you're at the, you get your PhD. What led you to come to Tulsa Community College? What are some events or things that happened to help you with that?
Yeah, so, you know, I love my education at the University of Tulsa. And at the same time, I kind of sense that there were a couple different directions that grad students usually went after they left. And I think University of Tulsa kind of did a good job preparing me for several different career paths. And I sensed, you know, for being a young woman who was also having children, that the model of publish or perish, you know, at a heavily inundated research institution was probably not going to work for me at that level of my, at that stage of my life. You know, I'd been in situations before where I had, you know, put out articles and presented at conferences and I felt like it brought out a side of me that I really didn't like, a side that was focused on, you know, taking instead of giving. And so when I started applying for jobs, and you know, there is a sense in which you go where the jobs are, right? You're not too picky when it comes to applying for jobs. And so my husband was working on his degree, and I knew I needed to stay in the area. And this position came open, and I remember applying for it and just kind of saying, I don't know what'll happen, but this would be a great job if I ended up getting the position. And I found out later I was one of like 100 candidates for the position. And I think that speaks to the quality that TCC provides, is that they do attract some really, really good candidates for their position. And so I don't know why, but they chose me for some final interviews. And and I remember sitting with Dr. Greg Stone, who's our provost at Metro, and he said, "Why do you want to work here?" And I remember saying that I didn't like the side of me that felt like I was in this for me and mm-hmm. for building my resume. Mm-hmm. And these will always be things that I wanted to do anyway, just mm-hmm. to contribute to the field. But I didn't like feeling the pressure of having to do that in order to maintain mm-hmm. my job. Mm-hmm. I felt like it was very cutthroat, and, mm-hmm. and it brought out a competitive side
right.
of me that I just didn't like.
Right.
And I said, I need to be in a position at least for a few years where the focus is on giving back mm-hmm. Rather than taking. And so that's kind of another thing that brought me mm-hmm. to service learning mm-hmm. was also, you know, if I could instill this in students as mm-hmm. well, that you know, no matter what status of life they're mm-hmm. in, no matter what background they come from, no matter what their class is in life, their race, orientation, mm-hmm. or gender, there's a place for you to give back, mm-hmm. and just to encourage them to look at their lives, at their skill sets, mm-hmm. and find some way to give back mm-hmm. to this world, I think is kind of one of my sub-goals in teaching.
That's really awesome. And it's really awesome that you came to TCC and that you realized that you wanted to do something that not only to contribute to the field, but to contribute to the community as well. And that that's why you came to TCC. I really like that.
Well, thank you.
So we're going to go back maybe a little bit.
Yeah, sure.
But why teach literature? Were you a reader as a child? What were you an English major in undergrad? What led you to the English language, literature, writing, etc.?
Yeah, so... Yeah, this is just going back to me taking myself way too seriously as a kid, but I remember I always had a book in hand. Mm-hmm. I remember, so my family was big into sports, mm-hmm. and I remember they had some tickets to OSU football games, mm-hmm. and I would go and I would bring a book, mm-hmm. and I would read the entire
yeah.
time. And you know, we'd go to the grocery store, mm-hmm. and I'd be hanging on to the end of the cart with a book in my hand, mm-hmm. like just hoping the cart didn't lead me into a shelf.
Mm-hmm. yeah.
So, yeah, we'd go to a restaurant and mm-hmm. my parents would have to be like, put your book away and talk with people.
Yeah.
And so I think I went into English mm-hmm. loving reading.
Mm-hmm.
And I think my undergraduate education really cultivated that.
Mm-hmm.
I do think that there were moments in my graduate experience where, you know, when you're reading 1,000 pages a week for,
mm-hmm.
for classes,
mm-hmm.
it becomes a little bit more of a chore.
Yeah.
And I think there have been, it's taken a while to get back to the love of reading.
Mm-hmm.
And I definitely don't think, you know, it's for everybody.
Mm-hmm.
You know, if you love reading just for fun,
mm-hmm.
I don't know that I'd recommend the English
right.
degree.
Right.
There's serious work to be done.
Mm-hmm.
And I think the English degree shows you that it's not just idle reading
mm-hmm.
anymore. Now everything you read, you know,
mm-hmm.
says something
mm-hmm.
and has a message. And
mm-hmm.
So it has taken a little
mm-hmm.
while to get back to return to,
mm-hmm.
you know, reading on the side
mm-hmm.
as a hobby.
Mm-hmm. So as a lover of literature yourself, and what's your philosophy as a literature teacher?
Yeah. I think, you know, I think as a literature professor, I feel like if I can help my students find their
mm-hmm.
voice and help them understand that their voice matters,
mm-hmm.
then my role actually gets easier,
mm-hmm.
and I become less of a lecturer and a, you know, educator.
Mm-hmm.
That I become more of a facilitator,
mm-hmm.
and I think as students learn that their ideas matter, they, you know, the discussions are richer
mm-hmm.
than if I'm just directing the
mm-hmm.
discussion. And
mm-hmm.
I'm still always looking for ways to do a better job of
mm-hmm.
that. And you might have some areas I can even improve on that. But I think that students learn these things best when they discover them for
mm-hmm.
themselves.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I can say, Jake, your ideas matter, and tell
mm-hmm.
you blue in the face.
Mm-hmm.
But until you realize that,
mm-hmm.
it's not going to mean
mm-hmm.
a whole lot. And so I feel like... you know, I feel like having you go out in the community
mm-hmm.
and make a difference
mm-hmm.
and you see that for yourself is going to mean more than me saying you can go out and
mm-hmm.
make a difference and your voice matters
right.
and your voice can change things.
Mm-hmm.
So I feel like giving students, first of all, the affirmation
mm-hmm.
that they matter, that
mm-hmm.
their ideas are valuable and that they can make a difference
mm-hmm.
is the most important thing that I can do
mm-hmm.
in the classroom.
Mm-hmm. And I can say personally, I've experienced that. I think you're a wonderful instructor. I enjoy, like I said, I enjoy the service learning aspect. And if you're looking to take one of Dr. Marangoni's classes, she is an expert at commentary on your papers. Like
free advertisement.
Yes, free advertisement. Take her classes if you want to become a better writer. You teach Comp 1 and Comp 2.
I do,
so,
yeah.
You know, I took her British Literature 2 class, so I'm obviously going a bit ahead, but I think her comments, no matter what class you're taking on your papers, are going to be wonderful. So it's a little advertisement, free advertisement.
Free plug.
So I know you teach British literature and American literature as well. Do you prefer one or the other, or do you think, you know, both are equally enjoyable? And if you have a particular opinion, why do you have that opinion?
Yeah, I mean, that's probably one of the toughest questions to answer. Mm-hmm. My field of specialty in mm-hmm. Going through my PhD was transatlantic modernism. Mm-hmm. And I really think that there are movements going on mm-hmm. That affected both mm-hmm. Britain and America mm-hmm. equally. And then they're responding to a mm-hmm. lot of the same experiments in the same way. Mm-hmm. They're looking at a lot of principles in the same way. They're developing a new sense of aesthetics mm-hmm. in the same way. I feel like a lot of American expressions of modernism, mm-hmm. especially, which is my mm-hmm. best area of expertise, tend to be bigger mm-hmm. and more individualistic than those going on in Britain at the same time. But you know, I think that's just kind of in keeping with mm-hmm. more of an American mm-hmm. version of
right.
modernism.
Right.
Go West, young man, mm-hmm. kind of mm-hmm. Modernism. But I love them both equally as mm-hmm. well. And I think I would be hard-pressed to say I had a favorite.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And I was just speaking for myself. I prefer British literature up until post-World War II. I think that America finally gets something right when they realize that white men are not the only voices in the world. And so...
It's true.
Post-World War II, we see, you know, LGBT literature, you know, African-American writing, which, of course, had been happening before. But, you
right.
know, we take more... As Americans, we take more of a stronger view, and we pay closer attention to people like, you know... James Baldwin and Zora Neale Hurston, and not just African American writers, but Asian writers, you know, the Joy Luck Club, Amy Tan, and, you know, Hispanic writers and Native American writers. So I think that, you know, post World War II, America finally gets it right. And that's where I finally get interested. But before that, definitely, I like the modernism of Britain, 1910s, 1920s, 1930s. And not to completely count out, you know, literature post 1950s in Britain. I love Doris Lessing. I think Doris Lessing was probably one of the best post World War II writers in England. So those are just my personal thoughts. Do you read? Have you read a lot of Doris Lessing?
A little bit,
mm-hmm.
a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
And I think just to kind of piggyback on mm-hmm. what you're saying, I really feel like at the community college level, I think it's kind of a shame that we lump.
Mm-hmm.
You know, romantic literature in the same classes.
Right.
I mean, it serves a purpose.
Mm-hmm.
I definitely get
mm-hmm.
that. But this is where I think I miss being able to offer some specialty classes
mm-hmm.
because I think being able to offer a class in, you know, post-World War II American literature
mm-hmm.
would be just wonderful.
Yeah.
Or being able to offer a class in, you know, World War II women's writers
mm-hmm.
would be really amazing.
Mm-hmm.
Even just like a female writer's class,
right?
You know, and so I think that is one thing that I miss out
mm-hmm.
on a little bit
mm-hmm.
with just offering the first 2 years of experience.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
yeah.
But there definitely is a purpose, and I understand.
Mm-hmm.
But as a student, I would totally agree. Like, if you're listening, TCC higher ups, teach a women's literature class and let Dr. Marangoni teach it. So, who are some of your favorite authors?
So. I would have to say, you know, a lot of the ones I wrote about in my dissertation,
mm-hmm.
Stevie Smith,
mm-hmm.
And for those of you who aren't familiar with her, she doodled these really crazy images and insisted that they be published with her poems, and they're actually pretty awesome. And a lot of times they, you know, they seem really innocent at first, and
mm-hmm.
then you start comparing them to the poem,
mm-hmm.
and you realize that the picture actually contradicts the poem in really weird ways,
mm-hmm.
and trying to resolve those actually creates a lot of new interpretations
mm-hmm.
of her poetry. And so I think she's really awesome. I of course love Samuel Beckett, and I've actually been involved with a project based. I'm working with a guy in Australia to help get some of his archives put online.
Mm-hmm.
You know, right now, if you want to go see Samuel Beckett's archives, you have to travel to like 6 different archives,
mm-hmm.
and. They're trying to put them all together into one archive, so for a very small fee, you can
mm-hmm.
have access to all of them. And so that's been really cool to kind of have an outlet in the digital humanities, mm-hmm. which are a really growing field in mm-hmm. the humanities. And with such a major author too, is such an honor. He was another prolific doodler, and he doodled a lot in his mm-hmm. manuscripts as he was trying to mm-hmm. write. And I'm just really interested in any times words coincide with mm-hmm. pictures, and especially when the words and pictures mm-hmm. kind of contradict each other. I think that resolving mm-hmm. That leads to mm-hmm. some really cool interpretations, and visuality and textuality can mm-hmm. go hand in hand. Dylan Thomas was another one in my dissertation. E. Cummings, Sylvia Plath, Kurt Vonnegut.
Mm-hmm.
I think those are some of the more recent mm-hmm. ones. But I would have to even say, you know, going back to my classical education, you know, Shakespeare remains a favorite, and some of the topics that he's dealing with, you know, mm-hmm. even as archaic as that language might seem, are actually very timely mm-hmm. still. Let's see. Ralph Ellison's Invisible Man remains a favorite.
Mm-hmm.
Anita Luce's Gentlemen Prefer Blondes mm-hmm. is just so funny in terms of the themes that it deals with mm-hmm. this, you know, on the surface, very ditzy and absent-minded blonde, really, like, scamming mm-hmm. these rich men for all that they're worth.
Yeah.
And there's the play going on there with the early modernism's infatuation with psychoanalysis.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think that's a really mm-hmm. funny work. But yeah, it's hard to, mm-hmm. to limit it, but I think those mm-hmm. have to be some of the top mm-hmm. favorites.
That's cool. And also, if you're just now joining us, we are talking with Dr. Kristen Marangoni, mm-hmm. assistant professor of English here at TCC. It's interesting you brought up E.E. Cummings. I don't hear a lot of people talk about him, and he's one of my absolute all-time favorite poets. The poem "It May Not Always Be So," I think, is one of the most beautiful poems I've ever written, that talks about how to handle, you know, love ending in such a graceful way. You know, I will take his hands and turn my face away and offer all happiness for me. And I love that poem. It's one
I
of my
think
favorites.
He writes the most beautiful poems.
He does. He does.
One of the first, I think it was the first essay that I published mm-hmm. was on his work. And I think he sometimes gets a bad rap about mm-hmm. being this anti-intellectual, and
mm-hmm.
I don't think that's true at all. Mm-hmm. I think that his poem, "Since feeling is first, who really cares about the syntax of things?
Mm-hmm.
Will never wholly kiss you," is almost like a thesis statement for his style of writing.
Mm-hmm.
You know, because feeling and emotions are so powerful, it doesn't necessarily matter the way that we say things.
Mm-hmm.
It matters our ability to capture those feelings. And so if you look closely at his writings, he almost creates this set of grammar and mechanics for himself by which, you know, so we might capitalize proper nouns.
Mm-hmm.
He capitalizes things that are important to him.
Mm-hmm.
And so he's taking that same principle, but mm-hmm. he's applying it to his own
mm-hmm.
standard.
Right.
And so words like spring and love
mm-hmm.
and flowers often get capital letters,
mm-hmm.
whereas his own name doesn't.
Right.
And I think that's fascinating.
I think so, too. I wish there was more people understood or talked about E.E. Cummings, because I just randomly came across E.E. Cummings one day, and I found that poem, "It May Not Always Be So," and I just remember that, like, I wasn't even in love or in a relationship at the time, and I just remember reading it, and, like, tears came to my eyes. It was just such a wonderful experience. And the same with Sylvia Plath, just to talk about her, I really enjoyed reading some of her poems. "November Graveyard" is one of my favorites. "The Stones," "I Lie on a Great Anvil," I enjoy that one, too. I don't enjoy writing about poetry, which I thought was odd, because in your class I chose to write about Dante Rossetti's Jenny, but I enjoy reading poetry.
Yeah.
I enjoy reading it. I think it's a really interesting experience, especially I like the confessional poets, so Sylvia Plath, Anne Sexton.
And Sylvia Plath actually started out as a visual artist.
Really? I did not know that.
Yeah, so we run the Scholastic Awards through TCC.
Mm-hmm.
And we used to have the writing contest. Now we only have the art contest,
mm-hmm.
But it's for high school students.
Mm-hmm.
And Sylvia Plath actually received a gold key in art,
when
she was in high school. So she went
mm-hmm.
through that program, and she was a visual artist first and then,
mm-hmm.
Textual artists later, which I think is really
fascinating. That is really cool. I did not know that. It's so interesting to see how closely art plays in with literature, like with Samuel Beckett's doodles and Stevie Smith's doodles. And, you know, like you just said that Sylvia Plath being a visual artist starting out, I think that's so cool. I've never noticed that before. That's really interesting.
Well, I think a lot of things about modernism are kind of hard to explain.
Mm-hmm.
And I think, you know, you say things like abstraction and fragmentation,
mm-hmm.
and chaos and despair.
Right.
You know, people have very different images that come into their minds. But when you ask somebody to Google modern art,
mm-hmm.
and then you show them, I think it makes a lot more sense what's going on in literature,
mm-hmm.
when you're able to see it first.
Right. That visual component can be really important in helping you understand these works. That's totally true. So what 10 books would you say that people need to read before they die?
I don't know that I'm going to have a full 10, but,
okay. The most important ones to you, in your opinion.
I'm a big fan of, Jonathan Safran Foer's Extremely Loud, Incredibly Close.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I think just looking at the,
mm-hmm.
9/11 tragedy and,
mm-hmm.
and, from the perspective of a child, it,
mm-hmm.
it just evokes such pathos and also play. I mean, like, you know, this was such a tragic event, and yet he's, you know, he has this flip book,
mm-hmm.
of this this man falling back up.
Mm-hmm.
And the classic image of the man falling out of the tower, he's inverted. And so as you flip your way through it, the man actually goes back up into the tower,
mm-hmm.
through this flip book at the,
mm-hmm.
bottom of the page. The last, I forget how many pages it is in the book, but it actually ends on a very hopeful note.
Mm-hmm.
And so thinking about what lessons we can learn from,
mm-hmm.
this, and if we can learn our lessons,
mm-hmm.
then maybe moving forward toward more healthy dynamics,
mm-hmm.
I think is a very appropriate way to end,
mm-hmm.
that book. I mentioned Gentlemen Prefer Blondes as just being a pretty funny, satirical take,
mm-hmm.
on some common infatuations,
mm-hmm.
of the modernist era. Novel and Yellow Paper is Stevie Smith's first book.
Mm-hmm.
And she starts the book off by saying, if you're a foot on the ground kind of person, you're not going to like this book, but I'm a very foot off the ground kind of person. And so, yeah, I mean, she's basically,
mm-hmm.
like just talking with,
mm-hmm.
your readers and saying, feel free to stop reading at any point.
Mm-hmm.
You know, no one's making you go on.
Mm-hmm.
But it's just very stream of consciousness,
mm-hmm.
very making fun of elite society.
Mm-hmm.
It's a pretty good read.
Mm-hmm.
I you know, any kind of works that deal with, you know, I like books that break with tradition,
mm-hmm.
and books that aren't afraid to address their audience,
mm-hmm.
and make fun of convention.
Mm-hmm.
I think of John Barth is another,
mm-hmm.
really famous postmodern author. I think of Slaughterhouse-Five. I think of, you know, going back to Shakespeare with, like, King Lear and,
mm-hmm.
As You Like It. Ralph Ellison with Invisible Man. Anything by Virginia Woolf, but particularly to The Lighthouse,
mm-hmm.
I feel is just so beautiful.
Mm-hmm.
I could go on and on, but,
mm-hmm.
I think that's a good start.
Mm-hmm. That's really cool. And I wrote an essay about Mrs. Dalloway for Dr. Marangoni's British Literature 2 class, and I so enjoyed having the space to talk about Virginia Woolf, because Virginia Woolf, since you're being just introduced to me too, Virginia Woolf is my favorite author, so it's really cool that we were able to make that connection with, you know, having such a love of Virginia Woolf. I really appreciated that. So what are you watching on, to sort of step away from literature, what are you watching on Netflix, Hulu, what movies, you know, what interests you in that?
Yeah, so I have kind of like several different types,
mm-hmm.
of shows going,
mm-hmm.
on, and some are just, you know, because of so my schedule now with small children,
mm-hmm.
involves, you know, picking them up after school,
mm-hmm.
usually around 3-ish,
mm-hmm.
but then that means I usually have work to do at,
mm-hmm.
night, so if, you know, they go to bed, I turn on the TV with something mindless,
mm-hmm.
and, you know, grade papers,
mm-hmm.
or a lesson plan,
mm-hmm.
and so, you know, I have one type of show a,
mm-hmm.
lot of times they're like very stereotype crime shows,
yeah.
or like Bones,
mm-hmm.
or White Collar,
mm-hmm.
or I started out with Suits, but then it got very complicated,
mm-hmm.
and I found I couldn't focus,
yeah.
and lesson prep at the same time. So there's one kind of type of show,
mm-hmm.
that I like to watch just in the background,
mm-hmm.
but when it comes to you know, serious shows,
mm-hmm.
you know, I would have to say, you know, things like The Handmaid's Tale.
Mm-hmm.
Really, you know, when I have the time to sit down and,
mm-hmm.
pay attention,
mm-hmm.
those are the kinds of shows,
mm-hmm.
that I would like to,
mm-hmm.
watch.
It's interesting you brought up The Handmaid's Tale. My friends and I have been watching that, and I think I read like the first half of the book, and I really wish I had read more going into it, but I think that's one of the things where the image helps the text come alive so much better. We get to see how Gilead works, and we get to see, you know, how color plays into the different statuses of women throughout the book. And I also think that, you know, as we've said, you know, we come from, you know, conservative backgrounds, and I was talking with a friend of mine about this the other day. It's easy to see how when you come from a fundamentalist or a conservative background, it's easy to see how you interacted with a society like Gilead on a smaller level, you know, in your church or in your family, and how, you know, you exist for the social order. You don't exist for yourself. Everything is about appearances, and your true thoughts are kept inside. And it's interesting you brought that up, because we've been having so many conversations. And I think that not just for myself personally and other people, I think politically, that came out at the right time. I think that the showrunners really put their finger on the pulse of America when the show aired. What are your thoughts?
Absolutely. I was never, you know, the victim of anything that mm-hmm. significant, mm-hmm. but I do feel like, it's very easy for me to sympathize with mm-hmm. with a lot of the characters, because on very micro levels, mm-hmm. I do feel like in the society that I grew up in, women were oppressed.
Yeah.
And like I remember as I think I was probably like 9 or 10, mm-hmm. and I remember telling somebody that, you know, I felt a calling to be a preacher.
Mm-hmm.
You know, every 9 and 10 and 11-year-old has, mm-hmm. you know, callings mm-hmm. that never pan out. And mm-hmm. I'm not saying it would have panned out, but I remember being told in no uncertain terms that I could never be
mm-hmm.
a preacher.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember just like how disheartening that was mm-hmm. to hear. And, you know, so I think I chose a profession where I'm allowed to, you know, be in the classroom, and
mm-hmm.
it's similar in a lot of ways,
right.
But like as an early child, I was picking up on some strengths that
mm-hmm.
I had, and I was being told no,
mm-hmm.
and I was being told no, you could never do that.
Mm-hmm.
That's not what girls do.
Mm-hmm.
And so I feel like there were a lot of times in my growing up
mm-hmm.
phase where I was told I couldn't do something
mm-hmm.
because I was a girl.
Mm-hmm.
You know, at a different point, I thought, well, maybe I'll be a missionary.
Mm-hmm.
You know, women can be missionaries, right?
Mm-hmm.
And I was told, well, if you want to be a missionary to a third world country, you're going to just be, you know, you're going to have enough to do with cooking and cleaning. You won't be able to have a job.
Mm-hmm.
And at that point I was thinking maybe I'd be a medical doctor.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I remember being told, no,
mm-hmm.
as a woman, that's not your job.
Mm-hmm.
And so I remember being shot down at a lot of different turns,
mm-hmm.
Because I was a woman.
Mm-hmm.
And I just think about how, you know, I mean, I think I had the, you know, within me to overcome that
mm-hmm.
and, you know, get a PhD
mm-hmm.
and, you know, life events, you know, have
mm-hmm.
a way of making you sometimes not follow through with what you thought
mm-hmm.
you'd do as an 11 or 12 year old.
Mm-hmm.
But I have no regrets with where I'm at.
Mm-hmm.
But I just think like a lesser person would not maybe be able to overcome that, and maybe would not have the courage
mm-hmm.
to say, yeah, I can still be something
mm-hmm.
as a woman.
Mm-hmm.
And I can step outside of this
mm-hmm.
and I can make my own choices
mm-hmm.
that, you know, I don't have to let culture dictate to
mm-hmm.
me what I can and what
mm-hmm.
I can't do.
Mm-hmm.
And so, yeah, I think I do really, I think that what you said too with the politics involved, or the coming out at a very specific point in time, I think is, is a thought that keeps
mm-hmm.
coming to my mind
mm-hmm.
as I'm watching this.
Mm-hmm.
I, you know, and I just think, I hope, My one concern is that the people who probably could really benefit from this probably
mm-hmm.
aren't the ones watching it.
Right.
And
right.
So, you know, I just think it's a lesson about here's what could happen
mm-hmm.
if this kind of behavior continues and
mm-hmm.
is taken to its logical extremes. But I think it's not necessarily getting to the people who could necessarily
right.
do something to stop that.
Right. And I think that the people who need to see it are the people who would be very happy to live in this world. And I think that's a really scary thought,
yeah.
in my opinion, because I was raised as a very fundamentalist, and, you know, listening to preaching from the pulpit, their world is Gilead. That's their perfect world, where everyone lives by the strict letter of the Bible. Women are kept in their place. Certain people are kept out of their place. You know, they're dead. And, you know, it's scary to me that people like that exist. And it's scary to me that a certain person is very close to, you know, the top position who believes that way.
Yeah. And the other thing I think is interesting is that, the women don't always get a pass.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I mean, I think about Serena mm-hmm. and the role that she had in mm-hmm. helping to orchestrate yeah. this movement. And, you know, I think they come down very hard on women who mm-hmm. don't help other women.
Right.
And I think that that's something that, mm-hmm. you know, when you're a woman in a position of power and you have the opportunity mm-hmm. to help fellow women and mm-hmm. you choose not to do that, I think yeah. there's a special place in hell reserved for those yeah. kinds of people. Yeah.
I mean, I think Serena is a villain, but I think the worst character, in my opinion, is Aunt Lydia. I think that Serena knows, even though she may not say, I think she knows what she did. I think that she knows that she shot herself while she was shooting everybody else. My main thought every time I see Serena is, you got what you wanted. May not be the way you wanted it, but you got what you wanted. And I think she knows that. I really do think she knows that. Aunt Lydia, on the other hand, Aunt Lydia has bought this hook, line, and sinker. She is in this no matter what happens, to a way that I don't think Serena is. I think Serena knows that she's done a bad thing. Aunt Lydia, this is great to her. And I think that's one of the main differences between Serena Joy and Aunt Lydia.
That's interesting. Serena's mistreatment stems from emotion, mm-hmm. where I think Aunt Lydia stems from just utter and complete malice. Mm-hmm. That's a really good point.
I think so. And I think that what makes her malice, Aunt Lydia's malice, even sicker is that she doesn't think it's malice. She thinks it's love. I mean,
yes.
She thinks that she is protecting these girls by forcing them to realize that they had better get what they're doing. And I was listening to Ann Dowd, the actor who plays Aunt Lydia.
Yeah.
And she was talking about that Aunt Lydia believe she's helping these girls, and maybe to a certain extent that she is, because, you know, I think of that scene where Elizabeth Moss, who plays Offred, gets her feet whipped because she did something. You know, that's a lot better than, you know, being hanged for something that she may do later. So Aunt Lydia has to get through to these girls that they had better get it, or something worse could happen to them. And I think that makes it even scarier that she thinks what she's doing is a beautiful thing, and, you know, we're watching it and we're horrified about what's going on.
Yeah. Sure, it's very thought provoking.
Yeah, very thought
provoking.
Yeah, definitely.
I think even just like the idea that women are commodities mm-hmm. is something that is a message that I think rings out very mm-hmm. like just the whole premise that mm-hmm. You can use the remaining fertile woman mm-hmm. at the disposal mm-hmm. of the powerful men is mm-hmm. is something that I don't know. I think we could benefit as a society from. Mm-hmm. learning a lesson from. You know, it seems really obscene when you take it to its logical mm-hmm. extent, like the show does, and we just think, like, well, we would never do that, but we do that in small ways in everyday society mm-hmm. all the time.
Yeah.
In marketing products by using sex. And mm-hmm. So I think it is a warning mm-hmm. to say, you know, people are not objects, mm-hmm. And, you know, we shouldn't treat them like that.
Right, right. And it's also interesting you brought up fertility. One of the main things I take away every time I watch it is that the women are allowed to be barren, but the men are not allowed to be sterile. And I thought that was a very interesting point they made, that women can have this shame, mm-hmm. and it's okay for women to have that shame, but men having the shame of being sterile is absolutely forbidden. I think of the doctor who talks to Offred, and he was like, you know, we're not allowed to say it, but it's probably yeah. these sterile men. And I just thought that is so interesting to make that comment about women being barren and infertile, that men are not allowed to be
so
sterile.
So many double standards.
Yeah, the double standards are yeah. just crazy. So moving on to something a bit happier, what are some of your hobbies and interests? What do you like to do?
Yeah, so, I mean, with three kids, mm-hmm. my options are a little limited, mm-hmm. but... I do really enjoy going out for a jog, and mm-hmm. I think that's kind of just my time to get away mm-hmm. and collect my thoughts, and also, you know, exercise mm-hmm. when I can fit that in. I'm a big crafter, mm-hmm. so I, you know, when I have the time mm-hmm. to, my opportunities are becoming fewer and fewer, mm-hmm. but you know. I'm not saying I'm the most artsy person in the world, but I can do a pretty good pre-made craft kit from Target, you know.
Oh, cool.
I think, you know, some of my hobbies have become, you know, hanging out with my kids mm-hmm. and trying to adopt some of their mm-hmm. their loves and their passions mm-hmm. too. And you know, so I make a pretty good Lego fort. And mm-hmm. can my 7-year-old's really into stuffed animals, so mm-hmm. we play things like vet clinic all mm-hmm. the time. And you know, just kind of hanging out with them and mm-hmm. and finding interests that I think just really any kind of community events are really popular at our house, and just getting out and being with the, I think there's energy from a bunch of people getting together over a common cause.
Right.
And I love introducing my kids to that. Just showing them that there's value in being together, and there's value in making community and bonding over over common causes. I think it's really cool.
That's really cool. What are some of the things you enjoy going to with your kids?
Yeah, so you know, anytime there's like a kids festival, like I think Chandler Park's doing a kids' day at the park with inflatables and, and face paint, and that's always a lot of fun. And sometimes I think I actually have a better time at those than my kids do. Just watching them, them have fun. My girls and I have done some local runs. We usually do the Tulsa Run. I recently moved downtown, and so we there's all kinds of 5Ks that go past our unit. So just be able to walk out and, you know, go register for a race is kind of a really cool thing. We're looking forward to Mayfest next week. And my daughter submitted a piece of art. And so that's kind of fun for a
that's cool.
See
yeah.
on display. But yeah, anything involving the community, local parades. We went to the Martin Luther King Day parade. I think they got more candy there than Halloween. So obviously they were in heaven, but also just be able to expose them to, you know, just the understanding that all people are valuable and deserve to be celebrated and upheld, I think was a really cool experience for me to be able to share with them. Even if they're just in it for the candy for right now.
One of the first assignments I had here at the newspaper, I started in the fall semester, so I started in August. So I did the Martin Luther King Jr. Parade that next January. And I remember, even as a college student, I brought home a bag full of candy. And so, like, I enjoyed it. Like, as much as I enjoyed, you know, celebrating Dr. King and his legacy, I enjoyed the candy, too. I'm not going to lie. And not only the candy, like, people were throwing out swag bags, and I got, like, a lifetime supply of chapstick and lanyards. And I think some, like, people had, like, little juice boxes. And, like, I'm out there darting. Like, I'm trying to beat the kids. It was so much fun.
Yeah, the QT kept passing out free pizza slices. And we kept saying, like, we would actually hold our hands up and say, no, the kids don't need any more. But I think by the time we left, we had 16 free pizza slices. And we're like, we don't know. Please give these to other people. We don't need this many. But they just kept passing them out. But yeah, it's part of the celebration. Food always makes things more happy.
So what are some of your favorite quotes? What are some quotes you live by?
Oh, boy. I wrote down one. And I think this kind of goes to, speaks to why I love literature too. But this one's from T.S. Eliot, and this is from a poem he wrote called Little Gideon. And he says, "We shall not cease from exploration, and the end of all our exploring will be to arrive where we started and to know the place for the first time." And I think what really speaks to me about literature is that you can have a poem that you come back to year after year after year, or you can have a short story that you come back to, and it means something slightly different to you every time you read it. And so, you know, you might be circling back around, but there's another layer of meaning that you haven't uncovered yet. And, you know, I love just the idea of literature not being fixed. You know, people think, well, it's fixed, it's static. And, and to me, it's not. It's always changing, and it's always, you know, When you look at meaning as being created as a process between the reader and the author and the text, there's always room for something new to say about something. And I think sometimes literature students come into my class and they say, how could I possibly say anything new about this work of literature? And I like to try to undo that as much as possible by the time they leave my class, so that, you know, students realize that they do have something to add, and they do have something to say that's never been said before. And so that idea of, we will not cease from exploring. And at the end of all our exploring, we might have come full circle, but we'll see it in a very new way. I think it's just so beautiful.
I agree. So what are some of your future plans, goals? Where do you want to be in 20 years, 30 years, 50 years?
Oh, wow. I'm not thinking that far down the line. But, you know, I think some people have, you know, goals to, you know, I think the classic business model is to, you know, start in an entry-level position and then gradually work your way up. And I think as a professor, it's a little different. I feel like I started at the top. You know, I don't necessarily have I mean, yeah, you know, as a professor, some places have tenure, and a little more job security mm-hmm. would be a good thing. Mm-hmm. But, you know, here at TCC, there's kind of a soft tenure, an implied mm-hmm. tenure. And, you know, so I would like to achieve that mm-hmm. someday. But I don't necessarily have goals to, you know, be world famous for anything mm-hmm. or to become some great administrator. I think I have the best job ever, and I'm so content doing mm-hmm. what I do. I love coming into work. Mm-hmm. I love the people I deal with. I love that semester to semester. My schedule changes. Mm-hmm. You know, and I love the, mm-hmm. you know, I do have some administrative duties with the service learning, but I love, you know, the unique challenges that mm-hmm. that brings about. I love advocating for service learning students mm-hmm. and service learning faculty and trying to bring them funds and recognition and awards. And, mm-hmm. and so from that perspective, I mean, I think my future plans and goals are to keep doing what I'm doing. Mm-hmm. I do have one pretty cool, project in the works. I had a friend that I knew back at Bob Jones mm-hmm. and, he actually got, dismissed at one point and, for being gay. Mm-hmm. And so that was a little bit of a challenging thing to kind of try to work through. And, mm-hmm. You know, he was one of my best friends, and then all of a sudden he's not there and nobody knows why. And, mm-hmm. We were able to reconnect in recent years. And mm-hmm. he said to me, we worked really well together back in our time, mm-hmm. At Bob Jones. And, I remember really feeling like I could count on you and, you know, we edited each other's work a little bit. And would you want to work on a project with me? And I was like, absolutely. That sounds really wonderful. And, I said, what did you have in mind? He said, well, you know, just us both going on the job market recently and realizing that, you know, most of the jobs are in the field of composition. Mm-hmm. Not a lot of them are exclusively literature jobs. Mm-hmm. And he said, I really feel like English programs across the country need to address this as mm-hmm. part of their grad programs, because right now, you know, an English degree is really a literature degree. And some institutions require you to take maybe a token class in comp ed or writing theory mm-hmm. or something like that. But very few even require that. Like mm-hmm. I didn't take any comp ed classes. Mm-hmm. And I really feel like I could have benefited from something like mm-hmm. that. Now, I think TU did a really good job preparing me for the bleak job market, mm-hmm. but I feel like every English PhD should require at least one comp ret class. Mm-hmm. And so this has kind of led to the creation of this whole separate field of composition and rhetoric. And so now you can get a PhD in composition and rhetoric. And so he was just saying, you know, now we have this huge divide between the two. Is there a way that we could, you know, write a book about bringing these two back together mm-hmm. and about helping English departments better justify themselves mm-hmm. in the age of this, you know, more and more corporate university mm-hmm. where, you know, degrees are being evaluated based on how many graduates they're turning out and what kind of career paths they directly lead to. And he said, you know, I feel like the field of English needs to kind of address this. And I said, yeah, that'd be absolutely wonderful. So we collected a bunch of contributors and submitted it to a bunch of presses, and it just got accepted by the journal Pedagogy, which is a journal coming out through Duke Press and Duke University Press. And so we that's going to be something that we're going to be working on even more in the coming years. Is I think it'll come out in 2021, and so we'll be working with our contributors to revise their submissions and to write an introduction. Mm-hmm. We're really excited about that. So that's kind of an immediate future.
That sounds very exciting. Yeah. Well, so as we start to wrap up, is there anything you'd like to leave, any imparting wisdom you'd like to leave with the audience?
I would just say, you know, if you're a student here at TCC, you matter and your voice matters. You can make a difference. You know, if you're a faculty, come talk to me about service learning. but yeah, I mean, I would just say do it, you know, find what your passion is in life. And it definitely took me a while to figure out what I wanted to study and do with my life. But there's nothing better than being in a job where you mm-hmm. love what you're doing, mm-hmm. Where you are truly satisfied. Mm-hmm. And no matter how long it takes for you to find that, no matter how many years of grad school, it's worth it.
Awesome. Thank you so much, Dr. Marangoni. Again, you've been listening to Interviews with Educators. We've been talking to Dr. Kristen Marangoni. My name is Jake White, and we will see you again next time.
Thanks for having me.
Bye.